Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research at Altus Group. I'm joined by Omar El-Tarai, our U.S. Director of Research. Together, we'll share the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. Omar, it's great to be with you. What do we got on our agenda today?
Yeah, so we have a packed agenda. We'll cover a lot of macro releases, including FDIC's quarterly banking profile, some consumer sentiment data, housing and construction data, as well as the latest GDP and inflation data before turning attention to markets and specifically CRE transactions.
Excellent. Well, how about you dive right in with that FDIC quarterly banking profile?
Certainly. This was released on the 26th of August, and it really covers the second quarter of 25. And well, the report and the release that they have is a little bit delayed. I think it's still certainly worth paying attention to because this covers pretty much the entirety of the U.S. banking system. And it does so in a rather aggregated way. But given that banks play such a critical role in CRE financing, it's worth paying attention to see some of these, even if it's just for confirmatory purposes, some of the trends that are underlying commercial real estate financing. And so while banks reported quarterly decreases in most portfolios and their overall credit profile was, I would say, very little changed quarter over quarter, we did see some headwinds or some challenges still within the commercial real estate segment of their portfolios. So the past due non-accrual rate for non-owner occupied CRE, multifamily CRE, as well as credit card portfolios remain well above their pre-pandemic averages. But on a lighter note or a more positive note, we did see some improvements across the real estate loan segments in terms of the 30 to 89 day past due rates. So I would call attention first to the loan portfolio that's secured by multifamily. We saw that 30 to 89 past due rate tick down to 24 basis points in the second quarter. That's from 42 basis points in the prior quarter. Another big loan segment, and specifically it's an all-encompassing commercial real estate segment, which is reported as the non-farm, non-residential commercial real estate. That also saw the 30 to 89 day past due rate tick down. And in the second quarter, that was at 27 basis points or 0.27%. And that's down from the 0.34% reported in the first quarter of 2025. So overall, that downtick in the past due rates or recently past due rates was overall positive. And then you did see the real estate portfolios as a whole. So this is inclusive of construction and development loans as well as resi. That also saw a slight downtick in the recently past due rate. But one thing that I would tie this FDIC report and data into is some of the SLOOS data that we got at the start of August, which really covered the period of July. And while the overall loans on the books are performing incrementally better in the second quarter, the SLOOS data, or the Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey, released at the start of August, did show that bank lenders were not quite putting the pedal to the metal in terms of lending yet, as many of them still reported tighter standards for their commercial real estate segments. But if I take this all together, I think that this is a overall sign that the banks are, while they aren't necessarily going in fully to commercial real estate, they are starting to dip a toe back into the water and they are still selectively lending. And again, now that was apparent in the FDIC's release, because you could see that commercial real estate generally grew by about 2% to 3%, depending on what loan segment you're looking at, on a year-on-year basis. So banks are coming back in, but they're not necessarily doing so in a gung-ho manner. But let's get out of bank land and hop into another massively important segment of the economy. Cole, what were you saying in terms of the recently released consumer confidence data?
Yeah, so this is the Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index, not to be confused with the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index. It's a little different in that they focus more on kind of business and labor conditions. So the latest release was the same day as the QBP, so August 26th. And it showed that the headline index on consumer confidence slipped by 1.3 points to 97.4. And that was down from a revised 98.7 in July. Thought this was a little interesting too, because the revision was an upward one for July of 1.5. So this actually changed the direction to one of a decline. But this index is split in terms of a present situation index and then an expectations index. So the present situation index fell 1.6 points to 131.2. And the expectations index, so gauging outlook for income, business, and employment, declined 1.2 points to 74.8. And that is below the threshold for a looming recession. And this is not as positive as some of the other stuff we were talking about, but consumers are still very concerned. They expressed in the survey growing concerns about job availability, growing concerns about inflation. In fact, increased 12-month inflation expectations to 6.2%, up from 5.7%. And the perceived likelihood of recession did increase, but honestly, this has been a pretty tight band for the last few years. More than two-thirds of respondents for a significant period of time over the last few years have said that they expect a recession to happen within the next 12 months. And again, take that with a grain of salt, because we have not had one, despite the fact that window keeps shifting for folks saying that they expect one. But it did spike on the month, so worth mentioning. So there's softer sentiment around jobs, softer sentiment around incomes. This would definitely be a concern for at least CRE sectors that are most exposed to discretionary consumer spending. So think retail, hospitality. And there are still concerns about the labor market, which I think could manifest itself in the office market as well. So definitely potential for slower leasing, rising vacancies, and some pressure on rents in those sectors. But the elevated inflation expectations compounded by the perceived erosion of purchasing power, that's a pretty dangerous combination here. There are definitely a couple of things to look out for as we get a few more months of this data, but seems like consumer sentiment or consumer confidence in this case still seems to be waning a little in the aftermath of April 2nd or Liberation Day. Now, Omar, I know that what people say they're going to do, what people say they believe, is a lot different than what they might actually be doing. And so that's why I think it's good to pair this with the personal income data. What did you see in that latest release?
Yeah, so this was released on August 29th from BEA, or Bureau of Economic Analysis. And it ultimately came out in the Personal Income and Outlays Report, which covered the period through July. The high-level takeaways: personal income rose 0.4% on the month, and spending rose 0.5%, both month-on-month measures. And in July, the Fed's preferred inflation measure, which is the personal consumption price index, or personal consumption expenditures price index, rose 0.2% from the month before, or at a 2.6% year-on-year rate, while the core PCE measure rose 0.3% on the month, or 2.9% year on year. Both of these were broadly in line with market expectations and economists' expectations leading up to the release, but they're both still well above that Fed's 2% target. And one thing I would note is that if you look at the most recent data, it is showing a bit of a concerning kind of upward trend. Also in the release was that the personal savings rate held steady through July at 4.4%. Now, if you look at the year-on-year wage growth and overall income growth, both that are in this release, they are still outpacing personal outlays or the change in personal outlays. To me, if you take that together, there's kind of reason to believe that there's still room to run for further consumption as well, which could ultimately continue to drive higher inflation. But all of that is becoming more and more contingent upon if the labor market remains as tight as it is and holds. So the July PCE data really, I would say, enforces or reinforces that higher for longer inflation and rate environment narrative. However, while that's what the data is saying, and the kind of backwards looking data seems to be saying, this stands in pretty sharp contrast to the market's current expectations, which, you know, at the start of September, or when we're recording this, is really showing that the market's expecting about a 90% probability for the Fed to cut by 25 basis points at their September meeting. To me, we've been in this higher for longer environment, but now there seems to be mounting pressure or mounting evidence for the Fed to cut rates, at least partially. And I know a big portion of the market that is would probably benefit from any sort of rate cut is the residential market. I know we got a batch of new home sales data. So Cole, what were some of the takeaways there?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a Census Bureau release, and they do it in partnership with HUD. But this data came out on the 25th. This is the new residential sales report. So it covers new single family home sales, or rather sales of new single family homes. And this was the report for July. And this number came in at a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 652,000. So that was a 0.6% decrease from June's revised new home sale figure of 656,000. But it was an 8.2% drop compared to a year prior, when we saw 710. Existing inventories are quite elevated. There were about 500,000 new homes for sale at the end of the month, and that was down only slightly from June's 502,000, but it's up a bit on the year. So up 7.3% year on year, and that equates to a 9.2-month supply. So I think you're seeing that a lot of builders are actually starting to cut prices now that inventory is rising. Again, the new home sale market is only a fraction of all single family home sales. And of course, as the existing home market has been frozen in part by elevated interest rates, you had seen some of that demand channeled into the new home market, but that's waning now as well. There's a lot of affordability pressures here. And on that note, another thing that's included in this release is pricing data. The median price of a new home or a new sold home actually fell 6% on the year. So again, sign that builders are cutting prices as that inventory builds up. Bottom line here, and we've said this takeaway a number of times, is that ownership remains out of reach for a lot of households. And a lot of that is due to elevated mortgage rates. So this affordability squeeze is really a boon for the multifamily sector, where you have seen some steady absorption despite the fact that there was a significant amount of new supply to come online the last few years. And you're seeing some modest rent growth there now. But I think it should be interesting to see how this data pans out over the next few months. But a new home market is definitely feeling the pressure here.
Another major release that we got at the end of August was the second estimate for GDP in the second quarter of 2025. So real GDP increased at an annual rate of 3.3% through Q2 2025, and that's according to the Bureau of Economic Analysis and released on August 28th. Compared to the prior estimate, real GDP was revised up from the 3% annual pace, and it really represents a rather significant rebound from Q1 2025's 0.5% contraction. Now, the increase in real GDP in the second quarter primarily reflected a decrease in imports, which for the non-economists or non-wannabe economists out there, you have to remember that imports are a subtraction in the GDP calculation. And also contributing to this 3.3% estimate was an increase in consumer spending, which grew at 1.6% year on year in the second quarter versus the 1.4% estimated in the first GDP estimate. The second estimate also revealed that business fixed investment expanded at a pretty impressive 5.7% annualized rate. That's sharply higher than the 1.9% in the first estimate. Corporate profits also surged to $65.5 billion versus the $90.6 billion decline in Q1. Now, the GDP rebound really supports CRE fundamentals broadly. I would say economic growth and affirming real estate or still strong real estate fundamentals should help drive a moderate recovery in real estate investment activity, assuming that positive trend persists. But the GDP also captures the strong consumer base, at least that we've seen thus far. However, one thing that I would note is that the decline in private investment within the most recent GDP data could be interpreted as a headwind, as it suggests that businesses are remaining a bit more cautious about their capital deployment and their capital spend. And on the same topic of kind of capital spending, a big area would be, or a related area is construction spending. So Cole, what were you seeing in the latest construction data?
Yeah, so this is another figure from the U.S. Census Bureau. This came out on September 2nd. And it's worth mentioning that this is from their value of construction put in place survey. So it's not necessarily all net new construction. It could be any form of construction. But there's a lot of good data in here. And what we saw is that for July, construction spending slid slightly, 0.1% to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of around $2.1 trillion. And that was slightly down from $2.14 trillion in June. So that is actually a 2.8% decline on the year, fairly modest and in line with forecasts. But the underlying data is where it gets really interesting here. So private construction spending dipped 0.2% to an annualized $1.62 trillion. And if you zoom in even further to private non-residential construction, which I think is what most of our listeners are interested in, so think office, factories, really any non-housing related projects, fell by 0.5% to $736.7 billion. That is the third consecutive monthly decline and a 2.5% drop from the December 2023 high. Now, within that, I think one number that's worth calling out is manufacturing. In the last few years, this made up a plurality of non-residential construction spending, anywhere from 30 to 40%. And that's actually fallen 6.7% from last year and 7.3% from its June 2024 peak. So just a little more than a year ago. The bulk of spending on manufacturing was for computer, electronics, and electrical manufacturing. And all of that is quickly decelerating as either CHIPS and IRA projects come online or they have been canceled, which I think there's been no shortage of stories about that in the last couple of months. There were some interesting bright spots in here, or at least one interesting bright spot. We saw, at least on an annual basis, spending on religious facilities is up nearly 20% annually. There was a nice Wall Street Journal article on this not long ago. I'd encourage people to check out. But there were also two other sectors that saw annual increases, at least as far as non-residential private spending is concerned, up 3% for power-related facilities and up 0.6% for amusement and recreation. But I do want to note, this data is not inflation adjusted, so it's possible that these are declining in real terms. Others that I wanted to call out, spending down 0.4% annually for office, down 10% annually for commercial, which in the census definition includes both warehouse and retail, and then down 5.1% for lodging. So definitely some interesting disparate or diverging takeaways rather for private non-residential spending, but broadly seeing a decline after a lot of this was propped up based on some of those acts from 2021, 2022. But Omar, a lot of stuff happening this week in the markets. You want to give folks an overview?
Yeah. So I actually wanted to touch on a handful of kind of themes that are happening as of the first 8 months of the year. And just to color what the capital markets effectively are looking like. So the first is on volatility. I think heading into this year, almost all market calls or outlooks were talking about some of the biggest risks being policy and geopolitical risk. And that ultimately fed into the expectations for elevated levels of geopolitical and regulatory risk were feeding into kind of these expectations for a much more volatile market. And while we have seen a few, I would say, bouts of elevated volatility, if you're looking at the VIX, for example, those were largely contained around Liberation Day or tariff turmoil was at the start of the second quarter. But otherwise, the volatility across the markets has been pretty contained. And I think that's impressive considering some of the news cycles and some of the headlines and topics that are being brought up, whether that's Fed independence or I would say just ongoing or we haven't seen a full resolution of the trade talks quite yet. So volatility was high on the radar, but overall, the markets seem to be finding general footing and seem to be shrugging off a lot of the otherwise loud headlines. The second big theme that's been playing out is a weaker dollar. So the dollar, as measured against a broad basket of other global currencies, is down about 7% from January, though we have seen some slight strengthening over the last month. But another area to look on kind of a weaker dollar, which I think is pretty insightful, is looking at gold. While the dollar's down about 7%, the price of gold is up about 34% on the year. The 10-year treasury, another key element into any sort of market outlook and bringing it closer to home in terms of U.S. CRE, while there have been some periods of a little bit more volatility and movement within the 10-year treasury, it's still right around that 4.3% range, which I think is certainly ripe for doing more CRE transactions, although a lower yield would be beneficial. But overall, the 10-year has been pretty stable and spreads have overall, whether you're looking at corporate or CMBS, have come down from some of the earlier highs that they've had this year. And then finally, into the equities markets, you'd have to be living under a rock to know that the tech-driven large U.S. indices or broad market indices have been doing quite well. They've been pushing new highs, at least over the last week, and ultimately are up about 11% year to date. And that compares to about 14% if you look at the global broad market equity indices. Now, I lead into all of this just because to get to bring it back close to real estate, if you look at listed real estate is underperforming the broad market. And even though many of the listed real estate companies, be them REITs or brokerages, have posted some pretty solid results in terms of their operating performance that speaks to the sound fundamentals of real estate, they haven't been getting as much market love as other sectors. So while the U.S. broad market indices are up about 11% on the year, listed U.S. real estate is up about 4%. So listed real estate hasn't benefited from the same positivity that the broader equity market has seen over the year. But, you know, Cole, within the realm of real estate, it's not just what's on exchanges and is in public markets. I know you just took a pretty deep dive into that. What were some of the trends you were seeing in the non-listed CRE space?
Yeah, so to give folks kind of a reminder, and for those who did tune into our last episode, which was an overview of some of the major kind of headline themes from the investment and transactions quarterly report that we just put out a few weeks ago. Each quarter, we do a bit of a zoom in. We try to find something interesting that showed up in the data and do a double click to figure out what's driving some of those trends or if there's something more interesting there. Last quarter, I did one on kind of deal size and other trends like the size of buildings that have transacted. This time, I did a piece or a dive on pricing trends, and specifically within service-oriented CRE. Why? Well, noticed an interesting trend in the data that showed that, you know, from the late 2010s through the pandemic, if you were to look at the median price per square foot of single asset non-distressed CRE transactions in service-oriented sectors, so think hospitality, retail, and office, these moved in lockstep late 2010s right up to the pandemic. And then by 2022, you saw these start to diverge. Pent-up consumer demand really propped up shops and hotels, brought customers back. And then there was a lagging effect for office, where folks didn't come back to the office quite as quickly. So if you were to draw the parallel to the pricing trends, you saw that this formed a bit of a hierarchy where hospitality was pricing highest, retail in the middle, office lagged behind. But the interesting thing I noticed was that in Q2 2025, the gap narrowed again. You saw that on a per square foot basis, median pricing for those three sectors converged around $140. And they all posted large quarterly and annual gains. But the broader piece is about the fact that this isn't just related to how all of these sectors have seen kind of broad trends, but that a lot of this is being driven by huge divergences in subsector trends. So I won't give all the details away, but a few kind of the headline takeaways are that if you were to look at retail, the premium that restaurants and bars have commanded relative to just general strip retail continues to widen a lot. If you were to look at hotels, full service used to trade at a discount relative to limited service on a per square foot basis, but then actually flipped after the GFC and continues to widen. Medical office is one that's gotten talked about a lot. It's quickly zooming away in terms of pricing relative to traditional office. And the typical medical office and traditional office sold for similar prices per square foot prior to the GFC. Now there's a huge spread, continues to widen. So overall story of price convergence on a sector basis is really actually driven by some interesting trends underneath at the subsector level. So you can't just explain away some of these trends with commentary on consumer spending or the return to office or maybe an investor preference for certain types of assets. But there are a lot of supply and demand trends that I think are driving this. In a couple of weeks here, there will be a piece up on the Altus site digging into these using almost entirely Reonomy data, which the report itself is based on. So excited to share that with folks and hopefully get some good questions about it. But that is it, I think, for today, but we have a few upcoming events and announcements. I did just want to remind folks, too, that Investment and Transactions Quarterly Report is still live on the Altus website. If you're curious about any of the trends in transaction volume, pricing, or sector and MSA level performance. But Omar, what else do we have coming up this week?
Yeah, so we have a moderately large week in terms of data releases. So on September 8th, we get some data on consumer credit. And then on Tuesday, September 9th, the NFIB Small Business Economic Trends and Small Business Optimism Index will be released. And then on Wednesday and Thursday, the 10th and 11th, we'll get some inflation data, first with the Producer Price Index being released on Wednesday, and then the Consumer Price Index data on Thursday. And then finally, to close out the week on September 12th, we're expecting a release of consumer sentiment data, the preliminary data for September.
Excellent. Omar, I think that's all the time we've got today. Before we sign off, I do want to encourage our listeners, if you like the show, please feel free to rate it 5 stars on Apple and or Spotify. Leave us comments there as well. We'd love to read them. Or feel free to send us an email. AltusResearch@AltusGroup.com is our address. We'd love to know what topics you've covered on the program. In the meantime, Omar, been a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking with you on another episode of CRE Exchange. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.